And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we're beginning our third week of lockdown here. And I've been watching the news, and I'm a little puzzled. We have people dying, getting sick. There's 40 cases in the town I live in. And people are still putting politics ahead of everything else. I'm looking at a story from Breitbart. A Texas Tech University professor, told his colleagues in an email last week he might reconsider his atheism if President Donald Trump died after contracting the Wuhan coronavirus. Really? At this point in time? I mean, if it was Hillary Clinton who'd been elected, he'd be burning offerings at her feet. I mean, this is just absolutely reprehensible, and that man does not need to be a professor. But those are the type that our educational authorities seem to worship. I know when I got my fifth degree at University of Texas at El Paso, and I had arranged my program was going to pay for my PhD, but I wasn't considered worthy. Because I was a veteran. And the powers that be at that school were anti-veteran. I mean, it just oozed out of every pore. And they made life for veterans difficult. And in fact, I had one professor pull me aside and say, look, they're doing everything they can to get your other professors, because I had made straight A's throughout the program. And one professor made it her goal in life to end that streak. And I was warned by I took some doctoral level courses. One of those professors took me aside and told me about it. Because her politics said military was evil. Politics. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-blowing to look at some of the silliness people are doing in the name of politics. Hospital in Buffalo, New York. One top executive mocked supporters of President Trump in comments on her Facebook page. She wanted Trump supporters to give up their ventilators for others. Why? She was the Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center's vice president for external affairs. And she was fired, finally, because somebody brought it to the attention of the powers that be. This woman got $226,850 a year as senior executive spokesperson. And she's on the internet posting messages like that. You know, with position and power and money goes great responsibility. And a lot of these people just haven't got it through their head yet. Now, this is a very serious situation. She wanted Trump supporters to pledge to give up their ventilators and not go to the hospital. And Rob Reiner, you know, for some reason, actors feel they're more privileged than everyone else and feel they're smarter than everyone else. And he's running around talking about Trump having blood on his hands because people are dying of coronavirus. People are dying of it. And this is not the time to indulge in petty politics. I'm just I stand amazed that he doesn't get it. He's every bit the meathead he played on All in the Family. And it, you know, it's rare that somebody has to answer for these silly-ass comments. And in Wuhan, they're trying to be business as usual, but the word coming out of there is the death rate is actually 10 times what the officials admit is actually... the death rate's 10 times what they admit. China sent 600,000 masks to the Netherlands. They're defective. The Wuhan whistleblower has vanished. He was one of the first doctors to blow the whistle on the coronavirus. At the same time, the Communist Party was trying to cover it all up. Dr. Ai Fen, Director of Emergency Management at Wuhan Central Hospital. Nobody has any idea where she's at or what happened to her. Now, even the most optimistic evaluations say that there's going to be in the neighborhood of 200,000 deaths. And universities, instead of being concerned about the welfare of their students, are more concerned about political correctness. I mean, my blog is it's called A View from the Cheap Seats, where I make comments, you know, from my point of view on a lot of things in the media. And for universities to be more concerned about political correctness than the life and the health of their students just boggles the mind. If you're that concerned about political correctness, you don't want it called the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus or my favorite that came from an NPR reporter, Kung Flu. Then quit your job, get a sign, and go march up and down in front of the White House like the other idiots. University of California released a set of guidelines that were written to deter students from using politically incorrect language during the pandemic. Really? Instead of being concerned and taking the money you put into having this written and published, putting it to student health just boggles the mind. Are you that removed from reality? It's gotten to the point that I can't ignore this stuff anymore. You know, for over 20 years, federal agencies warned everybody about the shortage of ventilators. Three presidential administrations. Nobody paid any attention. Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and they want to lay the blame on Donald Trump. Now, the stimulus package that was just passed to send every taxpayer who met certain requirements $1,200. AOC, as she likes to be called, just went into a meltdown that all the undocumented aliens didn't get a check. Really? Now, she is definitely far from a logical person. A lot of chased off 25,000 good paying jobs from Amazon to fight corporate corruption. Now, she didn't ask any of her constituents what they thought about it, but They're already looking at doing another $2 trillion, perhaps. And Nancy Pelosi is wanting to use these bills to fund all her wish list, like the new Green Deal. And my favorite, Planned Parenthood. During this time people are dying from the coronavirus, we have to protect the right to abortions. Well, yes, with people in lockdown, there'll be an upsurge in the population growth. But if you don't want to deal with the aftermath, don't deal with the foremath, so to speak. Now, there's some studies that are showing the coronavirus is airborne, or could be airborne. And masks are in very, very short supply. Now, worldwide, as of right now, 775,306 confirmed cases. Confirmed cases. A lot of people are not admitting that they have it. In the United States, 159,184. 2,945 confirmed deaths. But a lot of the frontline doctors and nurses are saying that the real numbers are not being released for fear of panicking the public. They talk about refrigeration trucks picking up loads of bodies at various hospitals. If that's the case, we're being done a disservice, not by Donald Trump, who everybody wants to dump in on his lap, but by the people who are not telling us the truth. Now, one of the things I found amusing was a bunch of the Hollywood millionaires getting together to sing John Lennon's Imagine to raise the hopes of all the people on the streets. Why not take them into your house? Most of you have mansions. Especially the ones in Beverly Hills. First thing Gavin Newsom did was say, well, you know, if we're going to close stores down, gun stores have to be closed first. DHS says, nope, gun stores stay open. Seventeen members of a British family all went to a funeral and came down with coronavirus. Well, I lived in California for a few years, and it was bumper to bumper, no matter what time of day or night. Right now, you can't find a car. And drivers are driving at over 100 miles an hour, those few that do get out there. Well, North Korea is swearing there's not a single case inside its borders, but they just built a new hospital anyway. China sent out all kinds of coronavirus test kits, and the Netherlands has rejected them because they're defective. And Whole Food workers are planning a sick out to demand better safety and more payment and more pay. There's never been an event so serious that there's not somebody going to try to take advantage of it. That's just goes with the territory. Well, it's there are 61 TSA screeners who have tested positive for coronavirus. A lot of people are still flying. I mean, you know, frankly, you can get good rates right now. But some of the busiest airports. Now, latest checkpoint travel numbers, 203,858 people were screened at checkpoints across the country on the 26th. A year ago at this time, 2.4 million were screened on that same day. Domestic and international flights in the U.S. are estimated to drop by about 68% due to coronavirus fears. Besides the 61 screening officials at airports from New York City to Seattle who have been confirmed to have it, 22 non-screening employees have, with relatively limited interaction with the traveling public, have also tested positive, which further supports the premise that it may well have become airborne. You know, viruses do tend to mutate, which is one of the things that makes them so difficult to deal with. There have been, the Queen went into seclusion. Prince Charles announced that he was positive. But now he's back out, you know, his stiff upper lip and all that. A Minnesota trooper pulled over a doctor for speeding, and he gave her his N95 medical mask. Should have been a speeding ticket, but instead, he turned it into something else. Well, we have got quite a number of closed businesses right now. And, you know, things are getting serious. And we still, in spite of everything else, have political correctness rearing its ugly head. Twitter just went after Laura Ingraham for breaking the rules against coronavirus misinformation. She praised the drug that has shown, it's an anti-malaria drug. President mentioned it. And automatically CNN said, well, if he is in favor of it, we've got to oppose it. So it does raise interesting questions as to what is motivating a lot of people right now. With all that having been said, I got to ask some questions about some of the... I'd written a book about the secrets of World War II, and I had some emails asking me for more information about some of the things I wrote about. Now... Now, Lend-Lease was a program during World War II where we actually gave away millions and millions of dollars of weapons and military equipment. But, of course, most of it has never been and will never be paid back. In 1943, Albert Speer, the German armaments minister, received but rejected a request from the German Navy for the manufacture of 50,000 ceremonial daggers, explaining to the very offended naval officers that that metal might serve the Reich's war effort more effectively if used for something besides officers' uniforms. You know, the German Navy's attitude was in sharp contrast to the more nonsense approach the U.S. Army showed with regard to uniform details. While millions of men were being mobilized, the Army realized even small economies might yield immense savings. So a lot of distinctive insignia were dispensed with during the war. Saved 75 tons of rare metal, paint, and enamel. You know, prior to the war, A lot of soldiers wore a small distinctive insignia showing their regiments on their uniforms. Doing away with that, I'm in fact going to cloth regimental insignia. It was very beneficial. You know, in June of 1944, the German railway system employed over 1.5 million people to operate an inventory of 988,000 freight cars. That generated 29,000 trains a day in support of the military. Now, Americans going into the military during World War II knew there was a certain chance of getting killed or injured. Overall, the 16.3 million men and women who served, 1.8% were killed in action. That's about 300,000. 7%, or 0.7%, died from other causes, such as accidents and disease. 4.1% were wounded and survived. That's about 700,000. Over half were injured by accident or disease during their service. Now, that number is vague because of the wide range of non-combat dangers soldiers faced. The largest one was VD, which ranged from merely inconvenient, such as gonorrhea, to the potentially fatal, which was syphilis. Overall, troops had a 1 in 14 chance of getting killed or seriously injured. Of course, this varied by the type of service. About 40% of those serving were in essentially civilian jobs, never got near the fighting. And of course, the infantry suffered the greatest number of casualties, and in many infantry units, the chance of death or injury exceeded 50%. Aircraft crews were also at great risk, but their job was considered glamorous, so they were folks lined up to fly. You know, U.S. troops were the highest paid during World War II. Enlisted personnel got in $1,994, an average of $750 a month, and officers got $2,200 a month. Troops in most other armies received token amounts, or rarely more than a few hundred a month. Officers, of course, did better, with many making more, about half of what U.S. officers were paid. And U.S. troops overseas were quick to note that not only were their dollars valuable, but so were the numerous goods they got as part of their normal rations. Sea rations used to have cigarettes and candy in them until the political correctness movement got going and the cigarettes and candy were taken out as not being healthy. The British referred to the GIs is oversexed, overpaid, and over here. Less well known in is the phrase often said of the less affluent British troops, underpaid, undersexed, and under Eisenhower. Eisenhower was in command of the overall Allied forces. You know, battlefields, especially after a battle, have never been particularly neat. Litter, such as bodies, weapons, and equipment, and usually looters abound. First noted during World War II, there was always seemed to be a lot of paper laying about on the battlefield. Newspapers, forms, pages from field manuals, packaging, labels, tags, all sorts of paper. During World War II, the bureaucracy and mass literacy met on the battlefield to add another element to the wreckage. Most troops could read and write, though there were still instances in World War II of there being inductees from some of the less affluent states. That was the first time they wore shoes. Now, while thousands of aircraft were lost in combat, the non-combat losses were actually substantial. Throughout the war, 40 to 45% of each month's German aircraft losses were actually due to accidents. Crash landing was very common, as were engine failures in flight. Allies' record was a little better, but not by a whole lot. Japanese were worse off, seeing over half a month's losses coming from non-combat causes. Now, this figure became absurdly high toward the end of the war when there was no fuel available to adequately train the pilots. Many of the kamikaze pilots were just agreeing they barely knew how to take off and land. And if a training field became overcast while pilot trainees were in the air, the Japanese knew they were going to lose most of them. because they were not landing in perfect conditions. And the Japanese pilots, those that survived their first flight, disdained parachutes is not befitting a warrior. So if your plane had a problem, you were going to die. Now, to many of the older pilots who had flown 25 years earlier in World War I, the situation didn't seem all that bad. 1914 to 1918, most of the planes and pilots lost were because of accidents. By 1940s, airplanes had become more reliable, but with so many new pilots being forced to operate in bad weather with insufficient ground crews, the accident rate was still substantial. Far worse than most people realized. Now, Allied troops invariably developed a grudging respect for the German troops they faced. Even during the last months of the war, the German troops are still winning battlefield victories because of their better training and tactics. And they were better at the rifle-to-rifle level. In the hundreds of World War II war games published in the past 30 years, the designers of these games had to deal with this situation in concrete terms. The historical games had to be accurately recreated in regard to the situations they dealt with, and this meant calculating the degree to which the Germans are more competent in combat. Now, there's really no way the casual reader of World War II history can grasp this relationship, but historian Trevor Dupuy came along, and his specialty was collecting information on hundreds of World War II battles. And he organized the data and reduced it to easily understood values. He called his technique the quantified judgment method. He realized not all factors could be quantified, and some professional judgment had to be used. So that leaves room for criticism, but doesn't necessarily negate what he said. And when he came up with the following relationships between the major combatants of World War II, percentage of German superiority over their opponents. When the Germans fought their opponents, when they fought the Allies, it was 26. When they fought the Russians, it was 58. And when the Allied superiority in the Pacific War, when we fought the Japanese, was 30%. So at no point in time was it a slam dunk, so to speak. You know, clearly the Germans weren't Superman, but they did have a distinctive battlefield advantage throughout the war. Of course, as the war went on, the superiority declined. In Russia, the German advantage in 1941 was over 200%. But as the war went on, that declined, although they were still much more efficient at the end of the war than were their enemies. And there were considerable differences between the units of all the armies. Among the Allies, the best divisions are about 50% better than the worst. And even among the German units, they found that same relationship. This was usually the effect of a superior or inferior division commander. You know, when the Allies dropped millions of tons of bombs on Germany and Japan, and the Axis powers didn't have much opportunity to return the favor. In particular, the United States was, I guess you could say, immune to such attacks, but not completely. The Japanese did make a few balloon bomb attacks on the West Coast, which caused death. And both German and Japan did make long-range aircraft that could, in fact, reach North America. Fortunately, they didn't make many of these aircraft or a major effort to bomb North America until near the end of the war. Now, we'll point out that at the end of World War I, an aircraft was found in a hangar that was, all the parts had been manufactured, it just hadn't been assembled, that would have allowed a crew to bomb New York City, and that was the plan. In late 1942, a Japanese submarine modified to carry a single-engine reconnaissance plane launched its aircraft off the coast of Oregon. Four 160-pound incendiary bombs were dropped in forest. The hope was to create a major fire that would cause a lot of assets to be put into fighting the fire. Fortunately for us, and unfortunately for them, a major fire did not start. Earlier in 1942, Japan put the first of its four-engine float planes, the H-8K, into service. Now, this was a very large aircraft, 124-foot wingspan, 92 feet long. Its defensive armament was four 7.7-millimeter and six 20-millimeter machine guns, and the range was 4,400 miles. It had the ability to carry over 4 tons of bombs and a top speed of 289 miles an hour. Japanese Admiral Kinzie did a little math and concluded that half a dozen H-8Ks could fly to the California coast, land on the water, be refueled by submarines, bomb Los Angeles, and then fly back to Japanese-held territory. Now, this plan was approved initially before the Battle of Midway and after the battle scaled back. Only three H-8Ks were sent out to bomb Hawaii, and bad weather forced them to drop their bombs blindly. Well, not to be discouraged, the Japanese planned to take 30 H-8Ks, refuel them from submarines off Baja California, and fly across the country to bomb the Texas oil fields. And the cooperation with German U-boats, some of which would be tankers, the H-8Ks would range up and down the east coast of the U.S., making air raids on major cities, mainly for terror and propaganda value. The Germans, of course, were eager to cooperate and prepared the tanker subs needed to refuel the H-8Ks. Only the deteriorating military situation for the Japanese caused this plan to be shelved. Had it been effective, it would have caused major chaos and might well have affected the war effort. Meanwhile, the Germans were working on their own long-range bombers. Late 1942, the four-engine ME-264 took its first flight. This aircraft, known as the America Bomber, would carry 2 tons of bombs for 9,500 miles. Total flying time was 45 hours, and it could fly from Europe to New York and back without landing or refueling. Like the Japanese, the Germans had other problems to distract them from the late 1942 on. The war with Russia was starting to go badly, and wasn't until early 44 the Germans decided to go ahead with a bombing campaign against North America. Although a six-engine Ju-290 made a flight to New York City, and it took a lot of photographs of potential targets, and it came back, it was a transport recon plane. Only 41 Ju-290s were built. The ME-264 was designed as a bomber, and with the introduction of the two-engine ME-262 fighter in 1944, the Germans converted the ME-264 from a propeller to a jet aircraft. Now, that would have outperformed anything we had at the time. This increased its speed from 373 to 500 miles an hour. At that speed, defensive armament and gunners could be dispensed with. After all, they thought nobody could catch them. Now, the Ju-290 flight to New York City didn't go unnoticed. British codebreakers learned about the flight and the ME-264 from secret German messages. British waited until September to tell us, who we promptly sent swarms of bombers to destroy the factory producing the ME-264. And that was that. But it could easily have turned out otherwise. The ME-264 first flew at the same time as the American B-29. By late 1944, B-29s were entering the service in large numbers, and the ME-264 could have done the very same. However, the Germans weren't able to spare the resources to build the ME-264. The B-29 project was more expensive than the Manhattan project that created the atomic bomb, and even if the Germans had produced, let's say, 100 ME-264s in 44, they would have lost most of their French airfields by the middle of the year. And above all, the aircraft wouldn't have been able to deliver enough bombs to make a whole lot of difference. It would have been uncomfortable for New Yorkers, of course. But a few squadrons of P-51 stationed at New York air bases would have given the German bombers a hard time. And the Germans were well aware of this and made plans to send over ME-164s or Ju-290s, each with two V-1 buzz bombs under their wings. The V-1 was a small, pilotless jet aircraft that, if launched 100 miles off the coast, could easily hit a target as large as New York City or even Boston. But it wouldn't have been a decisive weapon, more a terror tactic. And they firmly believed in the use of terror tactics. The Allied invasion of France in June of 44 upset these plans, though. Mere matter of timing. Like all things in World War II, this could very easily have happened. Now, American crews discovered the hard way that gas in the intestines expanded several times over when they were flying at altitudes of 20,000 feet and up. The discovery was made because most World War II aircraft were not pressurized. The thinner air caused the higher pressure intestinal gas to expand, a great discomfort to the victim. At higher altitudes, the crews would wear oxygen masks and very warm clothing, but normally the lower air pressure was not a problem. Passing gas could be painful, often debilitating, and sometimes even fatal. With thousands of bombers and fighters flying at those altitudes, clearly something had to be done. The solution, of course, was the diet. Certain foods cause most of the intestinal gas. Flyers solved that problem by removing from or reducing in their diets whatever possible beans, cabbage, corn, onions, and other foods that normally cause gas in humans. I mean, if everybody had eaten the beans, they could actually blow the plane out of the sky. Well, several World War II era aircraft are still in use today, and one's the most unlikely candidate. The DC-3, also known as the C-47 or Dakota in military uses, continues to fly in commercial service well into the 1990s. Over 1,000 of these planes are still flying worldwide, mostly owned by small domestic carriers in the U.S. and by some third world air transport companies. The state-of-the-art aircraft built in the mid-1930s, there were only 500 built. Over 35,000 during the 30s, there were 35,000 produced for use during World War II. In fact, the DC-3 was, in fact, the most widely manufactured aircraft during the war. When Allied paratroopers jumped, it was usually from a DC-3, which could carry 28 troops, but over 60 people when squeezed in during emergencies. With a maximum range of 2,100 miles and a top speed of 185 miles an hour, the DC-3 was the common cargo carrier. It could carry up to 7,500 pounds. It was looked at as by many as just a flying truck. The Japanese were so impressed, they examined and shot down DC-3s and went on to produce their own version, called the L-2D. They actually had a pre-war license to do that. Rugged, versatile, and much beloved by its two- and three-man crews, who affectionately nicknamed it Flying Dumbo or Goonie Bird, the DC-3 is one soldier from World War II that refuses to completely fade away. Some will still be in commercial service. In fact, they're in commercial service now, carrying cargo and passengers in out-of-the-way third-world countries. The only other pre-war aircraft that approaches the DC-3 in longevity is the Russian PO-2 biplane, first produced in 1920. It was simple, it was robust, and slow enough to efficiently continue its agricultural chores. It's used largely as a crop duster these days. I suppose you could mount a machine gun on it, but the problem with that is when you fire the gun, sometimes if the rotation is off, you can actually blow your propeller off your plane, which is not considered helpful to longevity. So how do you compare different combat divisions in terms of their relative capability on the battlefield? Winston Churchill pointed out in his memoirs, the planning of military operations usually overlooked this consideration until he began asking very pointed questions on the subject. It seems that British staff officers have been counting all friendly and enemy divisions as if they were actually the same. Now, some allowance, of course, will be made for special types like tank and parachute divisions, but little attention was paid to the generally wide differences in capabilities between divisions in terms of quality and quantity of troops, weapons, equipment, training, and leadership, not to mention morale and experience. Under Churchill's prodding, British staff officers began to look at these factors in mid to late 1944. The Germans had always taken into account many of these factors, as had the Russians. By D-Day, many U.S. staff officers learned to collect all the information they could on enemy units and translate enemy forces into equivalent U.S. divisions. Now, of course, this was a very rough approximation, but it was better than equating a green 9,000-man German infantry division with a veteran 16,000-man U.S. infantry division. While the Germans were quite good at ranking friendly and enemy divisions according to their current combat worth, Hitler became less willing to accept these assessments as the German situation deteriorated. In Russia, homegrown techniques, as well as ones borrowed from the Germans, gave the Russian commanders a good grasp of which units were capable of what. And the Russians continued to use these techniques for translating divisions from many different nations into numbers that actually meant something. And all the analysis systems used in World War II and since had to show, number one, how much damage a division could inflict. Now, of course, this was a matter of how many weapons a unit had, how good the weapons were, and how well the troops could use them. Two, how much damage the division could take. And it was mainly a matter of how many troops were in the unit, what kind of equipment the troops had, especially armor, how well supplied the unit was, and how well the unit's troops and leadership could cope with battlefield losses. You know, at a certain point in losses, the unit just became worthless. And number three, how mobile the unit was. And this was more of whether a unit had a lot of trucks and armored vehicles, and how well the troops could use and maintain this equipment. Now, one of the better examples of this kind of analysis in action was seen during the Stalingrad campaign in late 1942. When the Russians attacked, they made their major effort against non-German troops. The Russians knew the Italian, Hungarian, and Romanian divisions would crumble much more quickly than German divisions. And that was an obvious insight, but the Russians carried it out with such detail they bagged an entire German division and systematically eliminated it. The unit equivalent evaluation techniques used by the Russians at Stalingrad were employed for the rest of the war, but were often not noticed by most observers. After the war, it was discovered by examining records from both sides of the battle that the same size and composition, some units were twice as effective in combat than others. And this was the case in all armies. And the key factor appeared to be leadership, a factor that was recognized during the war, but not in any systematic way. Ironically, a method for accurately measuring divisions' effectiveness during wartime came from civilian researchers. The rise of historical war games, which began in the 1950s, produced a growing number of officers and civilians who possessed the skills needed to evaluate historical as well as current combat divisions. Turning divisions into numbers is still not an exact science, but it was practiced successfully during the 1991 Gulf War, and increasingly it's a standard part of the staff officer's toolbox worldwide. Unfortunately, if you don't do it correctly, you can send units in that absolutely get wiped out. Now, the principal unit for large-scale ground operation during World War II was the division. And divisions varied in size from about 4,500 men to as many as 20,000. Now, that depended on their armor of service and nationality, but all were more or less self-contained combat formations of all arms, infantry, armor, artillery, and support troops, and capable of some degree of sustained independent operation. The principal difference among the numerous type of divisions, infantry, armor, parachute, marine, security, fortress, and so forth, were due to the specialized missions to which they were dedicated. In general, the Allied nations had fewer specialized type of divisions than the Axis, which had serious occupation and internal security problems. This table summarizes the number of divisions available to each of the belligerent powers at the beginning of the indicated year, regardless of their location. You know, when you see tables such as this, available divisions of the particular power at war, everything is an estimate because nobody really knew. Now, for example, Australia, on the eve of the war, they had no divisions. But in the beginning of 1940, they had 7. 41, they had 10. 42, they had 10. 43, 9. Great Britain had 9 prior to the war. 34 in 1940, 35 and 41, 38 and 42. And they ended the war with 31 divisions, which meant a lot of casualties. Now, prior to the war, we had 8 divisions. In 1940, we had 24. In 41, we had 37. Now, December 7, 1941 was the beginning of the war for the U.S. That same year, we had two Marine divisions. And it got up to six in 1944. Now, the Treaty of Versailles in 1919 prohibited Germany from having an army of more than 100,000 men, all restricted to long-term enlistments, 25 years for officers, and 12 for other ranks. These troops were organized into 7 infantry and 3 cavalry divisions, which conformed to very rigid tables of organization described by the treaty. The infantry divisions each control recruiting and training within their particular military district. There were, in addition, 2 superior commands, group and commandos, as they were called, that were responsible for higher-level administrative and training. And although the Army was prohibited from having a general staff, an agency called the troop office covertly carried out general staff functions, among them conducting secret preparations for general mobilization of a much larger army on a day that Germany would openly rearm once more. Just had a couple of news flashes come in. James Goodrich, a renowned neurosurgeon who specialized in separating conjoined twins, has just died from coronavirus. And some myopic judge has ordered Texas to allow abortions to continue after the state banned them as part of its corona's mitigation strategy. So rather than use every medical capability possible to fight the virus, we're worrying about the rights of people to have abortions. That judge needs to be taken out and taken to a hospital and shown the results of his and or her stupid decisions. Now, the basic army expansion plan for the Germans was simple. When mobilization was proclaimed, each unit in the army would be filled up to 300% of official strength with new recruits and divide itself into 3 units. So each division could expand into 3 new divisions, each having a cadre of about 1/3 regular soldiers to train, season, and steady the new recruits, many of whom would have already had some training through various covert preparatory programs. As a result, Germany would be able to field about 30 divisions almost immediately. Prior to the war, they actually had 78. And in 1940, 189. In 41, 235. At the end of the war, they had 375 divisions. So you have to wonder, had the administrative force not surrendered, what would the military have done? Now, the plan was in existence when Hitler came to power at the end of January 1933. And it was the plan with which Hitler was able to create the seemingly unstoppable Wehrmacht of 1939 to 1942. Because literally there was nothing in the world that could oppose him at that point in time. The critical period for the expansion of the Reichswehr into the Wehrmacht was 1934 and 35. During this period, while, for example, the old 1st Infantry Division was becoming the new 1st, 11th, and 21st Infantry Division, Germany was for a time without an effective army. Some astute diplomacy coupled with a good deal of cowardice in France and Great Britain enabled Hitler to squeak by without a military showdown. So that with the addition of some armored divisions, by 1936, the Wehrmacht actually numbered 40 divisions. Over the next few years, as Hitler expanded Germany territorially, the army expanded further. With the Anschluss, which was when Germany took over Austria, they got a half dozen new divisions. The annexation of the Sudetenland by the end of 1938, Germany had 51 active divisions in the field. Meanwhile, of course, as men were passed out of the active army and into the reserve, Germany's mobilization potential began to rise. Of course, this mass army needed officers. 51 divisions required about 100,000. And there were 4,000 available in the old German army, including medical personnel, and 1,000 or so from the former Austrian army. So this pool was obviously insufficient to meet the need. recalling thousands of former World War I officers and commissioning many NCOs. Help, but that still wasn't enough. In the end, an efficient system of officer training camps was established. And all this expansion of the Army occurred at the same time the Navy was growing and a new Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was being created, which put further strains on Germany's manpower, not to mention needs of Hitler's small but growing bodyguard, the Waffen-SS. Well, in order to regulate manpower management on the eve of World War II, Hitler fixed an annual allocation of personnel with the Army to get 66% of all new recruits. About 6,000 went to the Waffen-SS. The Navy got 9%. The Air Force got 25%. And recruitment and training was the responsibility of the Wehrkreise. The system was extremely efficient. For example, Austria's 6 million inhabitants who constituted a single Wehrkreise. You did 16 infantry divisions, a panzer division, 7 alpine divisions, and 7 depot and reserve divisions in the course of the war. Not to mention number of recruits for the Air Force and the Navy. Divisions in the field received replacements from their Wehrkreise of origin and often sent back home to recuperate their strength. The 26th Infantry Division from the 21st Wehrkreise in the Rhineland was more or less destroyed in combat 9 times, each time being restored back to full strength by fresh drafts from the Rhineland. You know, in addition to being an efficient mobilization system, German Army raised units by waves. Each wave consisted of a number of newly raised and newly organized divisions, all of which were organized and equipped in precisely the same way. The idea was that an army of literally hundreds of divisions, all a senior commander had to know about an outfit was its wave, since it would tell him when it was raised, how much training it had, what its manpower and equipment allocations were, and how it was organized. If he knew that, that's all he needed to know. For example, second wave divisions were raised from reservists in August of 1939 on a table of organization and equipment similar to that of the pre-war first wave, with fewer light machine guns and no mortars. Third wave, raised at that time from the Landwehr, or the militia, was like the first wave, fewer engineers, signalmen, and other combat support elements. The fourth wave, raised simultaneously from newly conscripted manpower, is like the second, but lacked a lot of combat support elements. And the fifth wave, raised from older reservists during the Polish campaign, that's September and October 1939, and mostly Czech equipment. Waves contained from 4 to 24 divisions. The first 32 waves, divisions raised up in the autumn of 1944, were numbered, but the half dozen so subsequent ones received glorious names. Maybe so the men would not wonder what happened to the guys in the previous 32 waves. This was the system with which the German armed forces began World War II. And despite some clear faults, it was logical and orderly. However, the mounting casualties, the deteriorating strategic and political situation, and the peculiar internal political character of the Third Reich began to cause problems. Probably the biggest flaw in Germany's mobilization and manpower management arrangements was the desire of various leaders, both political and military, to build private armies for political purposes. Quite a lot of what we're seeing right now during this corona pandemic. Heinrich Himmler's Waffen-SS was the first and most obvious example of this. Originally, a relatively small contingent of Nazi Party troops earmarked as Hitler's personal bodyguard and triggermen, the Waffen-SS soon expanded into a self-contained army approaching 10% of Germany's military manpower by late 44. Included 25% of the panzer and mechanized divisions. And so desperate did Himmler become for manpower, he secured a monopoly on recruitment of the Volksdeutsche. The numerous German residents in other nations and then began to recruit from Germanic non-Germans such as Swedes and Danes and Dutchmen. Then from non-German Aryans such as French, Belgians and Spaniards and Italians, and finally from the allegedly inferior Slavic Croatians, Bosnians, and Ukrainians, African and Asian and Indian prisoners of war, not to mention Arab volunteers. In fact, the only people not consciously used were Jews and Gypsies, although some of them got in anyway, disguising themselves as German to hide among their enemies. And the Luftwaffe proved yet another drain on Germany's manpower. Goering very early established the notion that anything associated with air is part of his air force, including not merely air crews and base personnel, but anti-aircraft, parachute, and air-based security troops, not to mention his own personal bodyguard. But since the Luftwaffe eventually lost air superiority, it gradually came to have more men than it needed. Adamantly opposed to transferring these troops to the army, Goering secured Hitler's permission to organize them into a basically an Air Force field division. Fully 22 of these were raised, commanded by erstwhile airmen with no veteran cadres. Virtually all of them disintegrated upon their first contact with the enemy, mostly against the Russians. Of course, some Air Force units did perform well. The 11 parachute divisions and the Hermann Göring Panzer Parachute Division, which was the largest division ever committed to combat. In fact, it was so large it was later split into two divisions. But as with the Waffen-SS formations, these units were oversized with more men and, frankly, better men and more equipment than comparable regular army divisions. This was an extreme inefficient use of manpower and equipment. Germany raised about 761 divisions during the war, 670 in the Army, 48 in the Waffen-SS, 40 in the Luftwaffe, and 3 in the Navy. And the impreciseness is due to the fact that many of these divisions were raised during the closing weeks of the Hitler's Götterdämmerung. Few of which had very many troops. About 110 were destroyed in action, and 173, virtually our army, were disbanded due to severe losses. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow, when once again we'll be talking about things of interest. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.